It's raining.
Very astute, Your Grace.
I'm not fond of rain.
So you have often noted, Your Grace.
I'm a god. Shouldn't I have power over the weather? How can it rain if I don't want it to?
There are currently 25 gods in the court, Your Grace. Perhaps there are more who desire rain than those who don't.
The grass was cool and damp beneath Lightsong's sandaled toes, but a group of servants carried a wide canopy over him. Rain fell softly on the cloth. In Tae Talir, rainfalls were common, but they were never very strong.
I'll take a poll, then, of the other gods. See how many of them wanted it to rain today.
If you wish, Your Grace. It won't prove much.
It'll prove whose fault this is. And if it turns out that most of us want it to stop raining, perhaps that will start a theological crisis.
Your Grace, our doctrine is quite sound, I assure you.
And if the gods don't want it to rain, yet it still does?
Would you like it to be sunny all the time, Your Grace?
Sure.
And the farmers? Their crops would die without the rain.
It can rain on the crops, just not in the city. A few selective weather patterns shouldn't be too much for a god to accomplish.
The people need water to drink, Your Grace. The streets need to be washed clean. And what of the plants in the city? The beautiful trees, even this grass that you enjoy walking across, would die if the rain did not fall.
Well, I could just will them to continue living.
And that is what you do, Your Grace. Your soul knows that rain is best for the city, and so it rains, despite what your consciousness thinks.
By that argument, you could claim that anyone was a god, Larimar.
Not just anyone comes back from the dead, Your Grace. Nor do they have the power to heal the sick. And they certainly don't have your ability to foresee the future.
Good points, those.
The group approached the arena. The large circular structure was at the back of the Court of Gods, outside of the ring of palaces that surrounded the courtyard. Lightsong's entourage moved inside, red canopy still held above him, and entered the sand-covered arena yard. Then they moved up a ramp toward the seating area. The arena had four rows of seats for ordinary people, stone benches accommodating Tae Talir's citizens who were favored, lucky, or rich enough to get themselves into an assembly session. The upper reaches of the arena were reserved for the return. Here, close enough to hear what was said on the arena floor, yet far enough back to remain stately, were the boxes. Ornately carved in stone, they were large enough to hold the god's entire entourage. Lightsong could see that several of his colleagues had arrived, marked by the colorful canopies which sat above their boxes. Life Blesser was there, as was Mercy Star. They passed by the empty box usually reserved for Lightsong and made their way around the ring and approached a box topped by a green pavilion. Lushweaver lounged inside. Her green and silver dress was lavish and revealing, as always. Despite its rich trim and embroidery, it was little more than a long swath of cloth with a hole in the center for her head. That left it completely open on both sides from shoulder to calf, and Blush Weaver's thighs curved out lusciously on either side. She sat up smiling. Whew. Blush Weaver always treated him kindly, and she certainly did have a high opinion of him, but he felt like he had to be on guard at all times when he was around her. A man could be taken in by a woman such as she.
Lightsong, dear.
Blushweaver, my high priest tells me that you're to blame for this dreary weather.
Blushweaver raised an eyebrow, and to the side, standing with the other priests, Larimar flushed.
Oh, I like the rain. It's, different. I like things that are different.
Then you should be thoroughly bored by me, my dear.
Lightsong seated himself and took a handful of grapes, already peeled, from the bowl on his snack table.
Bored?
I strive for nothing if not mediocrity, and mediocrity is hardly different. In fact, I should say that it's highly in fashion in court these days.
You shouldn't say such things. The people might start to believe you.
You mistake me. That's why I say them. I figure if I can't do properly deific miracles like control the weather, then I might as well settle for the lesser miracle of being the one who tells the truth.
Our priests say that the purpose of the gods is not to play with weather or prevent disasters, but to provide visions and service to the people. Perhaps this attitude of yours is not the best way to see to their interests.
You're right. Of course. I've just had a revelation. Mediocrity isn't the best way to serve our people.
No, what is then?
Medium rare on a bed of sweet potato medallions with a slight garnish of garlic and a light white wine sauce.
Oh, you're incorrigible.
I am what the universe made me to be, my dear.
You bow before the whims of the universe, then?
What else would I do?
Fight it. Fight with everything. Force the universe to bow to you instead.
Yes, that's a charming concept, Blushweaver, but I believe that the universe and I are in slightly different weight categories.
I think you're wrong.
Are you saying I'm fat?
I'm saying that you needn't be so humble, Lightsong. You're a god.
A god who can't even make it stop raining.
I want it to storm in tempest. Maybe this drizzle is the compromise between us.
Lightsong popped another grape in his mouth, squishing it between his teeth, feeling the sweet juice leak onto his palate. He thought for a moment, chewing.
Blushweaver, dear, is this some kind of subtext to our current conversation? Because, as you might know, I'm absolutely terrible with subtext. It gives me a headache.
You can't get headaches.
Well, I can't get subtext either. Far too subtle for me. It takes effort to understand, and effort is, unfortunately, against my religion.
A new tenet for those who worship you?
Oh, not that religion. I'm secretly a worshipper of Austria. His is such a delightfully blunt theology. Black, white, no bothering with complications. Faith without any bothersome thinking.
You just don't know ostracism well enough. It's complex. If you're looking for something really simple, you should try the Pancal faith.
Don't they just worship the Return like the rest of us?
No, they have their own religion.
But everyone knows that the Pancal are practically Halandrins.
Blushweaver shrugged, watching the stadium floor below.
And how exactly did we get onto this tangent anyway? I swear, my dear, sometimes our conversations remind me of a broken sword.
Blushweaver raised an eyebrow.
Sharp as hell, but lacking a point.
You're the one who asked to meet with me, Lightsong.
Yes, but we both know that you wanted me to. What are you planning, Blushweaver?
Wait.
Ugh. First you imply that I should join with you. Now you won't tell me what you want me to do. I swear, woman, someday your ridiculous sense of drama is going to cause cataclysmic problems. Like, for instance, boredom in your companions.
It's not drama. It's respect.
Blushweaver nodded directly across the arena where the God King's box still stood empty. Golden throne sitting on a pedestal above the box itself.
Ah, feeling patriotic today, are we?
It's more that I'm curious.
About?
Her.
The Queen?
Of course her. Who else would I be speaking about?
Lightsong counted off the days. It had been a week.
Huh. A period of isolation is over, then.
Oh, you really should pay more attention, Lightsong.
Time tends to pass you by more quickly when you take no notice of it, my dear. In that, it's remarkably similar to most women I know.
With that, he accepted a handful of nuts and settled back to wait. Apparently, the people of Taetalir weren't fond of carriages, not even to carry gods. Ciri sat, somewhat bemused, as a group of servants carried her chair across the grass toward a large circular structure at the back of the Court of Gods. It was raining. She didn't care. She'd been cooped up for far too long. Ciri turned, twisting in her chair, looking back over a group of serving women who carried her dress's long golden train, keeping it off the wet grass. Around them all walked more women who held a large canopy to shield Ciri from the rain.
Could you move that aside? Let the rain fall on me?
The serving women glanced at each other.
Just for a little bit, I promise.
The women shared frowns, but slowed, allowing Ciri's porters to pull ahead and expose her to the rain. Ciri looked up, smiling as the drizzle fell on her face.
Oh, 7 days is far too long to spend indoors.
She basked for a long moment, enjoying the cool wetness on her skin and clothing. The grass looked inviting. She glanced back again.
I could walk, you know.
The serving women looked very, very uncomfortable about that concept.
Or not.
Ciri turned around as the women sped up, again covering the sky with their canopy. Walking was probably a bad idea, considering her dress's long train. She'd eventually chosen a gown far more daring than anything she'd ever worn before. The neckline was a touch low, and it had no sleeves. It also had a curious design that covered the front of her legs with a short skirt, yet was floor-length back. She'd picked it partially for the novelty, though she blushed every time she thought of how much leg it showed. They soon arrived at the arena, and her porters carried her up into it. Ciri was interested to see that it had no ceiling and had a sand-covered floor. Just above the floor, a colorful group of people were gathering on ranks of benches. Though some of them carried umbrellas, many ignored the light rain, chatting amiably amongst themselves. Ciri smiled at the crowd. 100 different colors and as many different clothing styles were represented. It was good to see some variety again, even if that variety was somewhat garish. Reporters carried her up to a large stone cleft built into the side of the building. Here, her women slid the canopy's poles into holes in the stone, allowing it to stand freely to cover the entire box. Servants scuttled about, getting things ready, and her porters lowered her chair. She stood, frowning. She was finally free of the palace, and yet it appeared she were going to have to sit above everyone else. Even the other gods, whom she assumed were in the other canopy boxes, were far away and separated from her by walls.
How is it they can make me feel alone, even when surrounded by hundreds of people?
She turned to one of the serving women.
The God King, where is he?
The woman gestured toward the other boxes like Ciri's.
He's in one of them?
No, Vessel. He will not arrive until all the gods are here.
Oh, makes sense, I guess.
Ciri sat back in her chair as several servants prepared food. She decided not to let herself get into a bad mood. At least she was outside, and she could see other people, even if she couldn't interact with them. She smiled to herself, leaning forward, elbows on knees as she studied the exotic colors below. What was she to make of Daedalia people? They were just so remarkably diverse. Some had dark skin, which meant they were from the edges of the Helandrin kingdom. Others had yellow hair, or even strange hair colors, blue and green, that came, Ciri assumed, from dyes. All wore brilliant clothing, as if there were no other option. Ornate hats were popular, both on men and women. Clothing ranged from vests and shorts to long robes and gowns.
How much time they must spend shopping?
Entourage after entourage arrived bearing a different set of colors, a hue and a metallic, usually. She counted the boxes. There was room for about 50 gods, but the court only had a couple of dozen. 25, wasn't it? In each procession, she saw a figure standing taller than the others. Some, mostly the women, were carried on chairs or couches. The men generally walked, some wearing intricate robes, others wearing nothing more than sandals and skirt. Ciri leaned forward, studying one god as he walked by her box. His bare chest made her blush, but it let her see his well-muscled body and toned flesh. He glanced at her, then nodded his head slightly in respect. His servants and priests bowed almost to the ground. The god passed on, having said nothing. Ciri sat back in her chair, shaking her head as one of the servants offered her food. There were still 4 or 5 gods left to arrive. Apparently, the Helandrin deities weren't as punctual as Bluefinger's schedule-keeping had led her to believe. Vivenna stepped through the gates, passing into the Helandrin Court of Gods, which was dominated by a group of large palaces. She hesitated, and small groups of people passed through on either side of her, though there wasn't much of a crowd. Denth had been right. It had been easy for her to get into the court. The priests at the gate had waved Vivenna through without even asking her identity. They had even let Parlin pass, assuming him to be her attendant. She turned back, glancing at the priests in their blue robes. She could see bubbles of colorfulness around them, indications of their strong biochroma. She'd been tutored about this. The priests guarding the gates had enough breath to get them to the first heightening, the state at which a person gained the ability to distinguish levels of breath in other people. Vivenna had it too. It wasn't that auras or colors looked different to her. In fact, the ability to distinguish breath was similar to the perfect pitch she had gained. Other people heard the same sounds as she did. She just had the ability to pick them apart. Vivenna saw how close a person had to get to one of the priests before the colors increased, and she saw exactly how much more colorful those hues became. This information let her know instinctively that each of the priests was of the first heightening. Parlin had one breath. The ordinary citizens who had to present papers to gain entrance to the court also each had only one breath. She could tell how strong that breath was and if the person was sick or not. The priests each had exactly 50 breaths, as did the majority of the wealthier individuals entering through the gates. A fair number had at least 200 breaths, enough for the second heightening and the perfect pitch it granted. Only a couple had more breaths than Vivenna, who had reached all the way to the third heightening, and the perfect color perception granted. She turned away from her study of the crowd. She'd been tutored about the heightenings, but she'd never expected to experience one firsthand. She felt dirty, perverse, particularly because the colors were just so beautiful. Her tutors had explained how the court was composed of a wide circle of palaces, but they had not mentioned how each palace was so harmoniously balanced in color. Each was a work of art, utilizing subtle color gradients that normal people just wouldn't be able to appreciate. They sat on a perfect, uniformly green lawn. It was trimmed carefully, and it was marred by neither road nor walkway. Thevenna stepped onto it, Parlin at her side, and she felt an urge to kick off her shoes and walk barefoot in the dew-moistened grass. That wouldn't be appropriate at all, and she stifled the impulse.
So, this is it. The court of the gods.
Thevenna nodded.
Good place to graze sheep.
I doubt that.
Goats, then?
The pair joined the small procession walking across the grass toward a large structure outside the circle of palaces. She'd been worried about standing out. After all, she still wore her simple Idrian dress with its high neck, practical fabric, and muted colors. She was beginning to realize that there just wasn't a way to stand out in Tetelir. The people around her wore such a stunning variety of costume that she wondered who had the imagination to design them all. Some were as modest as Vivenna's, and others even had muted colors, though these were usually accented by bright scarves or hats. Modesty in both design and color was obviously unfashionable, but not non-existent.
It's all about drawing attention. The whites and faded colors are a reaction against the bright colors. But because everyone tries so hard to look distinctive, nobody does.
Feeling a little more secure, she glanced at Parlin, who seemed more at peace now that they were away from the larger crowds in the city below.
Interesting buildings. People wear so much color, but that palace is just one color. Wonder why that is.
It's not one color. It's many different shades of the same color.
Red is red.
How could she explain? Each red was different, like notes on a musical scale. The walls were of pure red. The roof tiles, side columns, and other ornamentations were of slightly different shades, each distinct and intentional. The columns, for instance, formed stepping fifths of color, harmonizing with the base tint of the walls. It was like a symphony of hues. The building had obviously been constructed for a person who had achieved the third heightening, as only such a person would be able to see the ideal resonance. To others, well, it was just a bunch of red. They passed the Red Palace, approaching the arena. Entertainment was central to the lives of the Halandran gods. After all, one couldn't expect gods to do anything useful with their time. Often, they were diverted in their palaces or on the courtyard lawn, but for particularly large events, there was the arena, which also served as the location of Halandran legislative debates. Today, the priests of various gods would argue for the sport of their deities. Thevenna and Parlin waited their turn as the people crowded around the arena entrance. Thevenna glanced toward another gateway, wondering why nobody used it. The answer was made manifest as a figure approached. He was surrounded by servants, some carrying a canopy. All were dressed in blue and silver, matching their leader, who stood a good head taller than the others. He gave off a biochromatic aura, such as Vivenna had never seen, though, admittedly, she'd only been able to see them for a few hours. His bubble of enhanced color was enormous. It extended nearly 30 feet. To her first heightening senses, the god's breath registered as infinite, immeasurable. For the first time, Vivenna could see that there was something different about the return. They weren't just awakeners with more power. It was as if they had only a single breath, but that breath was so immensely powerful that it single-handedly propelled them to the upper heightenings. The god entered the arena through the open gateway. As she watched him, Vivenna's sense of awe dissipated. There was an arrogance in this man's posture, a dismissiveness to the way he entered freely while others waited their turn at an overcrowded entrance.
To keep him alive, he has to absorb a person's breath each week.
Vivenna had let herself become too relaxed, and she felt her revulsion return. Color and beauty couldn't cover up such enormous conceit, nor could it hide the sin of being a parasite living on the common people. The god disappeared into the arena. Evenna waited, thinking for a time about her own biochroma and what it meant. She was completely shocked when a man beside her suddenly lifted off the ground. The man rose into the air, lifted by his unusually long cloak. The cloth had stiffened, looking a little like a hand, as it held the man up high so he could see over the crowd.
How does he do that?
She'd been told that breath could give life to objects, but what did life mean? It seemed as if each of the fibers in the cloak were taut, like muscles. But how did it lift something so much heavier than it was? The man descended to the ground.
Your breath to mine.
The man's biochromatic aura grew stronger as he recovered his breath from the cloak.
We should be moving again soon. The crowd is thinning up ahead.
Indeed, soon the crowd started to progress. It wasn't long before Vivenna and Parlin entered the arena itself. They moved through the stone benches, choosing a place that wasn't too crowded, and Vivenna looked urgently through the boxes set above. The building was ornate, but not really very big, and so it didn't take her long to locate Ciri. When she did, her heart sank.
My sister. My poor sister.
Ciri was dressed in a scandalous golden dress that didn't even come down to her knees. It also had a plunging neckline. Ciri's hair, which even she should have been able to keep a dark brown, was instead the golden yellow of enjoyment, and there were deep red ribbons woven through it. She was being attended by dozens of servants.
Look what they've done to her. She must be frightened, senseless, forced to wear something like that, forced to keep her hair a color that matches her clothing, forced to be a slave to the God King.
Parlin's square-jawed face grew hard. He didn't often get angry, but Vivenna could see it in him now. She agreed. Ciri was being exploited. They were carrying her around and displaying her like some kind of trophy. It seemed to Vivenna a statement. They were saying they could take a chaste, innocent Idris woman and do whatever they wished with her.
What I'm doing is right. Coming to Halandrin was the best thing to do. Lemix might be dead, but I have to press onward. I have to find a way. I have to save my sister.
Vivenna? Why is everyone starting to bow?
Ciri played idly with one of the tassels on her dress. The final god was seating himself in his box.
That's 25. That should be all of them.
Suddenly, out in the audience, people began to rise, then kneel to the ground. Ciri stood, searching anxiously. What was she missing? Had the God King arrived? Or was this something else? Even the gods had gone down on their knees, though they didn't prostrate themselves as the mortals did. They all seemed to be bowing toward Ciri.
Some sort of ritual greeting for their new queen?
Then she saw it. Her dress exploded with color. The stone at her feet gained luster, and her very skin became more vibrant. In front of her, a white serving bowl began to shine. Then it seemed to stretch, the white colors splitting into the colors of the rainbow. A serving woman tugged on Ciri's sleeve from where she knelt below.
Vessel! Behind you!
Ciri turned. She found him standing behind her, though she had no idea how he had arrived. There was no entrance back there, just the stone wall. He wore white. She hadn't expected that. Something about his biochroma made the pure white split as she'd seen before, breaking up like light passed through a prism. Now, in daylight, she could finally see him properly. His clothing seemed to stretch, forming a robe-shaped rainbow and a colorful aura around him. And he was young, far younger than her shadowed meetings had suggested. He had supposedly reigned in Halandrin for decades, yet the man standing behind her appeared to be no more than 20. She stared at him, awed, mouth opening slightly, and any word she had planned to say escaped her. This man was a god. The very air distorted around him. How could she have not seen it? How could she possibly have treated him as she had? She felt like a fool. He regarded her, expression blank and unreadable, face so controlled that he reminded Ciri of Vivenna. Vivenna. She wouldn't have been so belligerent. She would have deserved marriage to such a majestic creature. The serving woman tugged again at Ciri's dress. Belatedly, Ciri dropped to her knees on the stone. Blushweaver knelt obediently on her cushion. Lightsong, however, remained standing, looking across the stadium toward a man he could barely see. The God King wore white, as he often did, for dramatic effect. As the only being to have achieved the 10th heightening, the God King had such a strong aura that he could draw color even from something colorless. Blushweaver glanced up at Lightsong.
Why do we kneel?
That's our king. Drop down, fool.
Then what will happen if I don't? They can't execute me. I'm a god.
You could hurt our cause.
Our cause? One meeting, and I'm already part of her plans.
However, Lightsong wasn't so foolish that he would needlessly earn the God King's ire. Why risk his perfect life, full of people who would carry his chair through the rain and shell his nuts for him? He knelt down on his cushion. The God King's superiority was arbitrary, much like Lightsong's divinity, both part of a grand game of make-believe. But he'd found that imaginary things were often the only items of real substance in people's lives. Ciri knelt on the stone before her husband, eyes downcast. She could still see Susabrun's white, clothed feet in front of her. Even they gave off an aura of color, the white straps of his sandals bending out colorful ribbons. Two coils of colorful rope hit the ground on either side of God King. Ciri watched as the ropes twisted with a life of their own, carefully wrapping around Susabrun and pulling him into the air. His white robes fluttered as he was towed up through the space between the canopy and the back wall. Ciri leaned forward, watching the ropes deliver her husband to a stone outcropping above. He sat back into a golden throne. The God King stretched out his hand. The people stood up and reseated themselves.
So, he's not going to sit with me?
A part of her was relieved, though another was just as frustrated. She'd been getting over her awe of being in Helandrin and being married to a god. Now, he'd gone and impressed her all over again. Troubled, she sat and stared out over the crowds, barely watching as a group of priests entered the arena below. What was she to make of Susabrun? He couldn't be a god. Not really. Could he? Austri was the true god of men, the one who sent the returned. The Helandrin had worshipped him, too, before the Many War and the exile of the royal family. Only after that had they fallen, becoming pagans, worshipping the iridescent tones, biochromatic breath, the returned, and art in general. And yet Ciri had never seen Austri. She'd been taught about him, but what was one to make of a creature like the God King? That divine halo of color wasn't something that she could ignore. She began to understand just how the people of Helandrin, after nearly being destroyed by their enemies, then being saved by the diplomatic skills of Peacegiver the Blessed, could look to the return for divine guidance. Ciri glanced to the side as a figure walked up the steps toward her box. It was Bluefingers, hands stained with ink, characteristically scribbling away on a ledger even as he entered her pavilion. He glanced up at the God King, nodded to himself, then made another annotation on his ledger.
I see that His Immortal Majesty is positioned and that you are properly displayed, Vessel.
Displayed?
Of course. That is the main purpose of your visit here. The returned didn't get much of a chance to see you when you first came to us.
Shouldn't they be paying attention to the priest down there? Instead of studying me, I mean?
Probably. In my experience, they rarely do what they're supposed to.
Ciri let the conversation lapse, thinking. Bluefingers had never explained his odd warning the other night.
Things are not what they seem.
Bluefingers, about the thing you told me the other night,
Bluefingers immediately shot her a look, eyes wide and insistent, cutting her off. He turned back to his ledger. The message was obvious. Not right now. Ciri resisted the urge to slump down. Below, priests of various colors stood on short platforms debating, despite the drizzling rain.
Bluefingers, are they really gods?
Vessel?
The returned. Do you really think that they're divine? That they can see the future?
I don't think I'm the right one to ask, Vessel. Let me fetch one of the priests. He can answer your questions. Just give me a minute.
No, I don't want a priest's opinion. I want the opinion of a regular person, like you. A typical follower.
All apologies, Vessel. But I'm not a follower of the Returned.
But you work in the palace.
And you live there, Vessel. Yet neither of us worship the iridescent tones. You are from Idris. I am from Pancal.
Pancal is the same as Halandrin.
Actually, Vessel, it's quite different.
But you're ruled by the God King.
We can accept him as king without worshipping him as our god. That is one of the reasons why I'm a steward in the palace instead of a priest.
His robes. Maybe that's why he always wears brown.
Ciri turned, glancing down at the priests upon their pedestals in the sand. Each wore a different set of colors, each representing, she assumed, a different one of the Returned.
So, what do you think of them?
Good people, but misguided. A little like I think of you, Vessel.
But how do you explain the God King's radiance?
Biochroma.
But the rest of the Returned don't bend white into colors like he does, do they?
No, indeed they do not. They, however, don't hold the wealth of breaths that he does.
So he is different. But why was he born with more?
He wasn't, Vessel. The God King's power does derive from the inherent biochroma of being a Returned, in that he is identical to the others. However, he holds something else. The Light of Peace, they call it. A fancy word for a treasure trove of breath that numbers somewhere in the tens of thousands.
That much?
The God Kings are said to be the only ones to ever achieve the tenth heightening. That is what makes light fracture around him, as well as gives him other abilities. The ability to break lifeless commands, for instance, or the ability to awaken objects without touching them, using only the sound of his voice. These powers are less a function of divinity and more a simple matter of holding so much breath.
But where did he get it?
The majority of it was originally gathered by Peacegiver the Blessed. He collected thousands of breaths during the days of the Many War. He passed those on to the first Halandrin God King. That inheritance has been transferred from father to son for centuries and has been enlarged since each God King is given two breaths a week instead of the one that the other Returned receive.
Oh.
Ciri found herself oddly disappointed by the news. Suzebron was not a god. He was simply a man with far more biochroma than normal. What of the Returned themselves? Ciri folded her arms again, still troubled. She'd never been forced to look objectively at what she believed. Austri was simply, God. You didn't question people when they talked about God. The Returned were usurpers who had cast the followers of Austri out of Halandrin, not true deities themselves. Yet, they were so majestic. Why had the royal family been cast out of Halandrin? She knew the official story taught in Idris that the royals hadn't supported the conflicts that led up to the Many War. For that, the people had revolted against them. That revolt had been led by Kalad the Usurper. Kalad. Though Ciri had avoided most of her tutorial sessions, even she knew the stories of that man. He was the one who had led the people of Halandrin in the heresy of building lifeless. He had created a powerful army of the creatures, one the likes of which had never been seen in the land. The stories said Kalad's lifeless had been more dangerous, new and distinctive, terrible and destructive. He'd eventually been defeated by Peacegiver, who had then ended the Many War through diplomacy. The story said that Kalad's armies were still out there somewhere, waiting to sweep down and destroy again. She knew that story was just a legend told by Hearthlight, but it still gave her shivers to consider. Regardless, Peacegiver had seized control and stopped the Many War. However, he had not restored Halandrin to its rightful rulers. Idris's histories claimed betrayal and treachery. The monks spoke of heresies that were too deeply ingrained in Halandrin. Surely the Halandrin people had their own version of the story. Watching the Returned in their boxes made Ciri wonder. One fact was obvious. Things in Halandrin were a whole lot less terrible than she had been taught. Vivenna cringed as the people in their colorful outfits crowded around her.
Things here are worse even than Matiter said.
Parlin seemed to have lost much of his nervousness about being in such a crowd. He was focused on the debating priests on the floor of the arena. Vivenna still couldn't decide if she thought the breath she held was horrible or wonderful. Gradually, she was coming to appreciate that it was horrible because of how wonderful it felt. The more people that surged around her, the more overwhelmed she felt by her breath-heightened perception of them. Surely, if Parlin only could sense the sheer scope of all those colors, he wouldn't gawk so dumbly at the costumes. Surely, if he could feel the people, he would feel boxed in like she did, unable to breathe.
That's it. I've seen Ciri and I know what they've done with her. It's time to go.
Turning, she stood and froze. A man was standing two rows back, and he was staring directly at Vivenna. She normally wouldn't have paid him any attention. He was wearing ragged brown clothing, ripped in places, his loose trousers tied at the waist by a simple rope. His facial hair was halfway between being a beard and just scruff. His hair was unkempt and came down to his shoulders. And he created a bubble of color around him, so bright that he had to be of the fifth heightening. He stared at her, meeting her eyes. She had a sudden and awful panicked sense that he knew exactly who she was. Oh. Vivenna stumbled back. The strange man didn't take his eyes off her. He shifted, pushing back his cloak and exposing a large, black-hilted sword at his belt. Few people in Halandrin wore weapons. This man didn't seem to care. How had he gotten that thing into the court? The people to the sides gave him a wide berth, and Vivenna swore she could sense something about that sword. It seemed to darken colors, deepen them, make tans into browns, reds into maroons, blues into navies, as if it had its own biochroma.
Parlin, we're leaving.
But
now.
Vivenna turned and rushed away. Her newfound biochromatic senses informed her that the man's eyes were still on her. Now that she realized it, she understood that his eyes on her were probably what had made her so uncomfortable in the first place.
The teachers spoke of this. Life sense, the ability to tell when there are people nearby, and to tell when they're watching you. Everyone has it to a small degree. Biochroma enhances that.
As soon as they entered the passage, the sense of being watched vanished.
I don't see why you wanted to leave.
We've seen what we needed to.
I guess. I thought you might want to listen to what the priests were saying about Idris.
What?
I think they might be declaring war. Don't we have a treaty?
Lord God of Colors!
Vivenna turned and scrambled back up into the open arena.
And I still say that we cannot possibly justify military action against Idris.
The man wore blue and gold. It was Stillmark's high priest. Lightsong couldn't quite remember the man's name. Ron Rover? The argument was not unexpected. Still, Lightsong leaned forward. Nonrova and his master, Stillmark, were both staunch traditionalists. They tended to argue against pretty much every proposal, but were well respected. Stillmark was nearly as old as Blushweaver and was considered wise. Lightsong rubbed his chin. Opposing Nonrova was Blushweaver's own high priestess, Inhana.
Oh, come now, do we really need to have this argument again? Idris is nothing more than a rebel enclave set up inside the borders of our own kingdom.
They keep to themselves holding lands we don't want anyway.
Lands we don't want? They hold every single pass to the northern kingdoms, every workable copper mine. They have military garrisons within striking distance of Tetalia, and they still claim to be ruled by the rightful kings of Halandrin.
Lightsong eyed the group of priests that seemed to agree wholeheartedly with Inhana.
You've seeded the group with people sympathetic to your cause.
Of course, so did the others. I just did a better job.
The debate continued, other priests stepping up to argue for and against an assault on Idris. The priests spoke the concerns of the people of the nation. Part of their duty was to listen to the people, study issues of national import, then discuss them here so that the gods, who didn't have the opportunity to go out among the people, could be kept informed. If an issue came to a head, the gods would make their judgments. They were divided into subgroups, each having responsibility for a certain area. Some gods were in charge of civic issues. Others governed agreements and treaties. Idris was not a new topic for the assembly. However, Lightsong had never seen the discussion become so explicit and extreme. Sanctions had been discussed, blockades, even some military pressure. But war? Nobody had said the word yet, but they all knew what the priests were discussing. He could not dispel the images from his dreams, visions of death and pain. Light Song did not accept them as prophetic, but he did acknowledge that they must have something to do with the worries inside his subconscious. He feared what war would do to them. Perhaps he was just a coward. It did seem that suppressing Idris would solve so much.
You're behind this debate, aren't you?
Behind it? Oh, dear Light Song, the priests decide the issues to be discussed. Gods don't bother with such mundanity.
I'm sure. You want my lifeless commands.
I wouldn't say that. I just want you to be informed, should you...
Mushweaver trailed off as Light Song gave her a flat look.
All colors. Of course I need your commands, Light Song. Why else would I go to all the trouble to get you up here? You're a very difficult person to manipulate, you know that?
Nonsense. You just have to promise me that I won't have to do a thing. And then I'll do anything you want.
Anything?
Anything that doesn't require doing anything.
That's nothing, then.
Is it?
Yes.
Well, that's something.
Blushweaver rolled her eyes. Light Song was more troubled than he let on. The arguments for attack had never been so strong. There was proof of a military buildup in Idris, and the Highlanders had been particularly stingy with the northern passes lately. Beyond that, there was a growing belief that the Returned were weaker than they'd been in previous generations. Not less powerful in Biochroma, just less divine, less benevolent, less wise. Light Song happened to agree. It had been 3 years since the Returned had given up his or her life to heal someone. The people were growing impatient with their gods.
There's more, isn't there?
Blushweaver was still lounging back, delicately eating cherries.
What aren't they saying?
Light Song, dear, you were right. Bring you to government proceedings and it absolutely corrupts you.
I just don't like secrets. They make my brain itch, keep me awake at night. Engaging in politics is like pulling off a bandage. Best to get the pain over with quickly.
I've told you already. The focus of all this is that woman.
The queen.
They sent the wrong one. The younger instead of the elder.
I know. Clever of them.
Clever? It's downright brilliant. Do you know what a fortune we paid these last 20 years to spy upon, study, and learn about the eldest daughter? Those of us who thought to be careful even study the second daughter, the one they've made a monk. But the youngest? Nobody gave her half a thought.
And so the Idrians sent a random element into court. One that upsets plans and conniving that our politicians have been working on for decades.
It was brilliant.
Nobody knows anything about her. My spies and Idris insist the girl is of little consequence, which makes me worry that she is even more dangerous than I'd feared.
And you don't think, maybe, that you might be overreacting a tad?
Oh, and tell me, what would you do if you wanted to inject an agent into the court? Would you, perhaps, set up a decoy that you could display, drawing attention away from the real agent, whom you could train secretly with a clandestine agenda?
She has a point.
Maybe. Living among so many scheming people tended to make one see plots everywhere. However, the plot that Blushweaver suggested had a very serious chance of being dangerous. What better way to get an assassin close to the God King than to send someone to marry him? No, that wouldn't be it. Killing the God King would just cause Halandrin to go on the rampage. But if they'd sent a woman skilled in the art of manipulation, a woman who could secretly poison the mind of the God King...
We need to be ready to act. I won't sit and let my kingdom be pulled out from under me. I won't idly be cast out as the royals once were. You control a fourth of our lifeless. That's 10,000 soldiers who don't need to eat, who can march tirelessly. If we convince the other three with commands to join us...
Red Song thought for a moment, then nodded and stood.
What are you doing?
I think I'll go for a stroll.
Where?
Light Song glanced over at the queen.
Oh, bless the colors. Light Song, do not ruin this. We walk a very delicate line here.
I'll do my best.
I don't suppose I can talk you out of interacting with her?
My dear, I at least have to chat with her. Nothing would be more intolerable than being overthrown by a person with whom I'd never even had a nice conversation.
Blue Fingers wandered off sometime during the court proceedings. Ciri didn't notice. She was too busy watching the priest's debate. She had to be misunderstanding. Surely they couldn't be thinking about attacking Idris. What would be the point? What would Halandrin gain? As the priests finished their discussion on that topic, Ciri turned to one of her serving women.
What was that about?
The woman glanced down, not answering.
They sounded like they were discussing war. They wouldn't really invade, would they?
The woman shuffled uncomfortably, then glanced at one of her companions. That woman rushed away. A few moments later, the servant returned with Trilides. Ciri frowned slightly. She did not like speaking with the man.
Yes, Vessel?
The priests. What were they just discussing?
The homeland of Idris, Vessel.
I know that much. What do they want with Idris?
It seemed to me, Vessel, that they were arguing about whether or not to attack the rebel province and bring it back under proper royal control.
Rebel province?
Yes, Vessel. Your people are in a state of rebellion against the rest of the kingdom.
But you rebelled against us.
Trilides raised an eyebrow.
Different viewpoints on history, indeed. I can see how somebody might think as you do, but you wouldn't really attack us, would you? We sent you a queen just as you demanded. Because of that, the next God King will have royal blood. Assuming the current God King ever decides to consummate our marriage.
It is likely nothing, Vessel. The gods simply needed to be apprised of the current political climate of Tetalir.
Trilidi's words didn't offer Ciri much comfort. She shivered. Should she be doing something? Trying to politic in Idris's defense?
Vessel?
Yes?
There is a matter of some delicacy, I fear, that I must discuss with you.
What is that?
You are familiar with monarchies. Indeed, you are the daughter of a king. I assume that you know how important it is to a government that there is a secure, stable plan for succession.
I guess.
Therefore, you realize that it is of no small importance that an heir be provided as quickly as possible.
We're working on that.
With all due respect, Vessel, there is some degree of disagreement upon whether or not you actually are.
Ciri blushed further, hair reddening as she glanced away from those callous eyes.
Such arguments, of course, are limited to those inside the palace. You can trust in the discretion of our staff and priests.
How do you know? I mean, about us. Maybe we are working on it. Maybe you'll have an heir before you know it.
Vessel, do you honestly think that we would take an unfamiliar foreign woman and place her in close proximity to our most holy of gods without keeping watch?
Of course. Of course they were watching. To make sure I didn't hurt the God King. To make certain things were going according to plan.
Being naked before her husband was bad enough. To be so exposed before men like Trilides, men who saw her not as a woman but as an annoyance, felt even worse somehow. She found herself slouching, arms wrapping around her chest and its revealing neckline.
Now, we understand that the God King may not be what you expected. He may even be difficult to work with. You are a woman, however, and should know how to use your charms to motivate.
How can I motivate if I can't talk to him or look at him?
I'm sure you'll find a way. You only have one task in this palace. You want to make certain Idris is protected? Well, give the God King's priesthood what we desire, and your rebels will earn our appreciation. My colleagues and I have no small influence in the court, and we can do much to safeguard your homeland. All we ask is that you perform this single duty. Give us an heir. Give the kingdom stability. Not everything in Halandrin is as cohesive as it may appear to you at first.
Ciri remained slouched down, not looking at Trilides.
I see that you understand. I feel that
a procession was approaching Ciri's box. Its members wore gold and red, and a tall figure at the front caused them to shine with vibrant color. Trilides frowned and glanced at her.
We will speak further if it becomes necessary. Do your duty, Vessel, or there will be consequences.
With that, the priest withdrew. She didn't look dangerous. That, more than anything else, made Lightsong inclined to believe Blushweaver's concerns.
I've been in the court far, far too long. All my life, actually.
The queen was a small thing, much younger than he had expected. Barely a woman. She looked intimidated as he nodded to her, waiting while his priests arranged furniture for him. Then he sat, accepting some grapes from the queen's serving women, even though he wasn't hungry.
Your Majesty, it is a pleasure to meet you, I'm sure.
You're sure?
Figure of speech, my dear. A rather redundant one, which is quite appropriate, since I am rather a redundant person.
The girl cocked her head.
Collis? I'm probably the only return that she's met besides the God Keep. What a bad first impression.
I'm pleased to make your acquaintance, Your Grace.
The Queen turned as a serving woman spoke in her ear.
Lightsong the Brave, Lord of Heroes.
The woman's arrival should have put an end to the discussion of war, but instead she had only exacerbated them. He kept his eyes open, for he feared the images of destruction he would see flashing inside his mind's eye if he so much as blinked. They waited, like Galad's phantoms, hovering just beyond his vision. He couldn't accept those dreams as foretellings. If he did, it meant that he was a god. And if that were the case, then he feared greatly for them all. On the outside, he simply gave the queen his third most charming smile and popped a grape into his mouth.
No need to be so formal, Your Majesty. You will soon realize that among the return, I am by far the least. If cows could return, they'd undoubtedly be ranked higher than I.
Might I inquire as to the nature of your visitation?
Too formal. Not at ease. Uncomfortable around those of high rank. Could it be possible that she was genuine? No. It was likely an act to put him at ease, to make him underestimate her. Or was he just thinking too much?
Goddess, take you, Blushweaver. I really don't want to be a part of this.
Lightsong almost withdrew, but then that wouldn't be very pleasant of him. And contrary to some of the things he said, Lightsong did like being pleasant.
Best to be kind. That way, if she ever does take over the kingdom, perhaps she'll behead me last. You ask after the nature of my visitation. I believe it has no nature, Your Majesty, other than to appear natural, at which I have already failed by staring at you for far too long while thinking to myself about your place in this mess.
The queen frowned again. Lightsong popped a grape in his mouth.
Wonderful things. Delightfully sweet, wrapped in their own little package. Deceptive, really. So hard and dry on the outside, but so delectable on the inside. Don't you think?
We don't have many grapes in Idris, Your Grace.
I'm rather the opposite, you know. Fluffy and pretty on the outside, without much import on the inside. But I guess that is beside the point. You, my dear, are a very welcome sight. Much more so than a grape.
How is that, Your Grace?
Oh, we haven't had a queen in such a long time. Since before my return, in fact. An old suzerain up there really has been moping about the palace lately, looking forlorn. It's good he has a woman in his life.
Thank you for the compliment, Your Grace.
You're welcome. I'll make up a few more if you like. Well, then that's it. Blushweaver was right. I probably shouldn't have come.
All right. What is going on here?
Your Majesty?
Are you making fun of me?
Probably.
But you're supposed to be a god. Just when I thought things in this city were starting to make sense, the priests start yelling at me, then you come along. What am I supposed to do with you? You seem more like a schoolboy than a god.
Ah, you have found me out. I killed the real god and took his place. I've come to hold you ransom for your sweets.
Aren't you supposed to be, I don't know, distinguished or something?
My dear, this is what passes for being distinguished in Halandrin. I am, of course, lying through my teeth. You shouldn't base your opinion of the others upon what you think of me. They're all much more deific than I am.
I thought you were the god of bravery.
Technically.
You seem more like the god of jesters to me.
Oh, I've applied for the position and been turned down. You should see the person they have doing the job. Dull as a rock and twice as ugly. No, I wasn't lying that time. Mirthgiver, god of laughter. If ever there was a god more poorly suited to his position than I, it's he.
I don't understand you. It appears there's a lot I don't understand in this city.
This woman is no fake. Or if she is, then she's the best actress I've ever met.
That meant something. Something important. It was possible there were mundane reasons this girl had been sent instead of her sister. Sickness on the part of the elder daughter, perhaps. But Lightsong didn't buy that. She was part of something. A plot. Or perhaps several. And whatever those plots were, she didn't know about them.
God's phantoms! This child is going to get ripped apart and fed to the wolves.
But what could he really do about it? Lightsong stood, causing his priests to begin packing his things. The girl watched with confusion as he nodded to her, giving her a wan smile of farewell. She stood and curtsied slightly, though she probably didn't need to. She was his queen, even if she wasn't herself returned. Lightsong turned to go and stopped, recalling his own first few months in the court and the confusion he'd known. He reached over, laying a gentle hand on her shoulder.
Don't let them get to you, child.
The Venna walked back toward Lemix's house, dissecting the argument she'd heard at the Court of Gods. Her tutors had instructed her that discussions in the court assembly didn't always lead to action. Just because they talked of war didn't mean it would happen. This discussion, however, seemed to mean more. It was too passionate, with too many voices for one side. It indicated that her father was right and that war was inevitable. She walked with her head down on a nearly deserted street. She was beginning to learn that she could avoid the roiling masses by walking through more residential sections of the city. It appeared that people in Tae Talir liked to be where everybody else was. The street was in a wealthy neighborhood, had a slate stone sidewalk running along the side of it. It made for pleasant walking. Harlan walked beside her, occasionally pausing to study ferns or palm trees. The Halandrans liked plants. Most of the homes were shaded by trees, vines, and exotic blooming shrubs. In Idris, each of the large homes along the street would have been considered a mansion. But here, they were only of average size, probably the homes of merchants.
I need to stay focused. Is Halandran going to attack soon? Or is this just a prelude to something still months, perhaps years away?
Real action wouldn't occur until the gods voted, and Vivenna wasn't sure what it would take to get them to that point. She shook her head. Only one day in Tae Talir, and already she knew her training and tutorials hadn't prepared her half as well as she'd assumed. Vivenna felt as if she knew nothing, and that left her feeling very lost. She was not the confident, competent woman she'd assumed herself to be. The frightening truth was, should she have been sent to become the God King's bride, she would have been nearly as ineffective and confused as poor Ciri undoubtedly was. They turned a corner. Vivenna, trusting in Parlin's amazing sense of direction to get them back to Lemix's house, and they passed under the gaze of one of the silent Daedanir statues. The proud warrior stood with sword raised above his stone head, his armor, carved into the statue, augmented by a red scarf tied and flapping around his neck. He looked dramatic, as if he were going gloriously to war. It wasn't long before they approached the steps to Lemix's house. Vivenna froze, however, when she saw that the door was hanging from one hinge. The lower part was cracked, as if it had been kicked very hard. Harlan pulled up beside her.
Cole Latterson!
His hand went to the long hunting knife at his belt, and he glanced around. Vivenna stepped back, nerves itching to flee. And yet, where would she go? The mercenaries were her only connection in the city. Denth and Tung Fa could have handled an attack, right? Someone approached from the other side of the door. Her biochromatic senses warned her of the proximity. She laid a hand on Parlin's arm, preparing to bolt.
Oh, it's you!
What happened? Were you attacked?
Denth glanced at the door.
Nah!
Denth pushed the door open and waved her in. Through the broken door, she could see that furniture had been ripped apart. There were holes in the walls and pictures were slashed and broken. Denth wandered back inside, kicking aside some stuffing from a cushion, making his way toward the stairs. Several of the steps had been broken. Denth glanced back, noting Vivenna's confusion.
Well, we did say we were going to search the house, Princess. Figured we might as well do a good job of it.
Vivenna sat down very carefully, half expecting the chair to collapse beneath her. Tong Fa and Denth had been very thorough in their search. They had broken every bit of wood in the house, it seemed, including chair legs. Fortunately, her current chair had been propped up reasonably well, and it held her weight. The desk in front of her was splintered. The drawers had been removed, and a false back had been revealed, the compartment emptied. A group of papers and several bags sat on the desktop.
And that's everything.
Tong Fa lounged on a broken couch, its stuffing sticking out awkwardly.
Did you have to break so much?
Had to be certain. You'd be surprised where people hide things.
Inside the front door?
Would you have thought to look there?
Of course not.
Sounds like a pretty good hiding place to me, then. We knocked and thought we'd found a hollow space. Just turned out to be a section of different wood, but it was important to check.
People get really clever when it comes to hiding important stuff.
You know the thing I hate about being a mercenary?
Vivenna raised an eyebrow.
Splinters.
No hazard pay for those.
Oh, now you're just being silly.
Vivenna sorted through the items on the table. One of the bags clinked suggestively. Vivenna undid the drawstring and pulled open the top. Gold glistened inside. A lot of it.
Little over 5,000 marks in there. Lemmix had it stashed all over the house. Found one bar of it in the leg of your chair.
Got easier when we discovered the paper he used to remind himself of where he hid it all.
5,000 marks?
Seems like old Lemmix was storing up quite a little nest egg. That, mixed with the amount of breath he held, he must have extorted even more from Idris than I assumed.
You gave it to me. You could have taken it and spent it.
Actually, we did. Took about 10 bits for lunch. Should be here any minute.
Vivenna met his eyes.
Now, there's what I'm talking about, eh, Tonks? If I'd been, say, a butler, would she be looking at me like that? Just because I didn't take the money and run? Why does everyone expect a mercenary to rob them? Look through those papers, Princess. We'll wait for you downstairs.
Vivenna didn't move. She was increasingly uncertain of her purpose in the city. Yet she still had Danth and Tong Fa, and, surprisingly, she was finding herself growing attached to them after just a short time. How many soldiers in her father's army, good men, all of them, would have been able to resist running off with 5,000 marks? There was more to these mercenaries than they let on. She turned her attention to the books, letters, and papers on the desk.